Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 20th of June 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we will be joined today by Patrick Hennison of 21st Century Wire. Well, we're going to stay on the story of Grenfell Tower and that horrific fire. And we're going to try and dig deeper into some of the events that are taking place. All is clearly not as it seems. Well, the BBC has finally got stuck in. And here's one of their headlines. Four ministers were warned about tower block fire risks. Now, this is a particularly interesting article and encourage people to read it. I shall be commenting further on the BBC a little bit later in the news. But they're pointing out that back in March 2014, the parliamentary group responsible for fire risks was warning the government and, in fact, warned four government ministers. But this is part of what they said. Surely when you already have credible evidence to justify updating the guidance, which will lead to saving of lives, you don't need to wait another 3 years in addition to the two already spent since the research findings were updated in order to take action. Another comment here, as there are estimated to be another 4,000 older tower blocks in the UK without automatic sprinkler protection, can we really afford to wait for another tragedy to occur before we amend this weakness? So the BBC finally starting to ask some interesting questions, but we're going to comment on that a little bit later on.
So that's from 2014.
2014, Mike.
And did you see anything in the BBC about a documentary they made in the 1980s on this issue?
They didn't seem to mention that I came across, Mike.
Well, let's look at a short clip then.
With no alternative accommodation, many councils are desperately trying to remedy the defects in their system-built housing stock so that their tenants can go on living in them. A new industry has sprung up, offering methods of repairing the systems. Tower blocks hundreds of feet high are being completely recovered or reclad in new materials guaranteed to prevent rain reaching the joints.
The only way that you can repair the present industrialised systems is by the use of other untried and untested remedial works. And we already have evidence of some of those repair systems failing because they've been inadequately researched and evaluated.
What sort of risks do you think there are from using systems that haven't been appraised properly?
Well, to take a very obvious one, there's the fire risk, and I think it's absolutely essential that anything that has been placed on or around an existing block should be considered very carefully in relation to a serious fire.
On the question of a fire risk, do you think that there are now systems being used which represent a fire risk?
Frankly, yes.
Would you be prepared to name them?
No.
I do believe that there are blocks that, blocks of flats that, if action is not taken speedily, will provide a major risk to the people who live in them in the future.
So that was the mid-80s. That was a BBC documentary. So it isn't just in the last 2 or 3 years that this has been of concern.
Very interesting, that documentary, Mike, and what I'm going to be saying a little bit later, I'll say it now anyway, is of course the BBC now rapidly pointing a finger at other people. But of course the BBC, with a budget of £3.74 billion, apparently totally ignorant, according to its latest reports, of these fire risks or local people actually complaining about the fire risks. So to me, this is of course further evidence of the BBC as a massive propaganda machine, just claiming with all of its local regional offices and reporters out on the ground that it had no idea this was taking place.
Patrick, let's bring you in at this point. I mean, the BBC obviously knew nothing about child abuse within its own organisation either. So, you know, what is the BBC? It doesn't seem to be terribly capable as a media outlet.
Yeah, especially if you don't have knowledge of what's in your own archives. And, you know, that's an excellent documentary, credit where credit's due. I think that was produced by Adam Curtis, and I think that aired in the early 1980s. I've seen the entire film about tower blocks. And so what that film says to me is very much a Veritas production. It's very straightforward production. It says that 50 years of complete systematic corruption and cover-up regarding the construction and the repair, maintenance of social housing in Britain going all the way back to the late 1950s. And every single crisis, every single controversy that's unfolded has been something to cover up something that was a mistake that was made previous to that. And so Grenfell Tower is the culmination of 50 years of systematic government and corporate collusion, corruption, and cover-ups. And you can only look at this story through that lens. And there's the evidence right there. You've just given a prime example of that. And also, I might add, in The Observer this weekend, Ronnie King, who's the government's chief fire inspector and advisor to the cabinet, has basically said that multiple warnings, this issue has been brought up. He's been rebuffed on numerous times. And he said that what does it take? Another King's Cross? Does it take significant loss of life for the government to actually do something or make a change in this way? So a lot of talk about health and safety, a lot of talk about risk assessments, piling all kinds of costs onto persons and businesses and so forth. And when it comes to some of the biggest fire hazards in the country, in the world, like this tower block, nothing, no real health and safety, no real risk assessment, but huge amounts of money have been made in the process of putting a Band-Aid on what could be even a concrete issue. We saw right there the cladding issue in the 70s and 80s was to basically keep the concrete from falling off because they misconstructed the materials with the metal rods and so forth. But now we got flammable material outside of a giant tower block. It went up like a matchstick. So, yeah, it's self-explanatory.
Yeah, look, Patrick, just briefly, I mean, a lot of people think that this is incompetence at work here. But this goes way beyond incompetence because this is the result of corruption, deliberate, intentional corruption of various kinds. This is not incompetence, right?
It's not incompetence. You're right. It's not incompetence. It's complete competence. Complete competence and total thievery and collusion between certain corporate entities, people within the council, within the TMO. Otherwise, this would never have happened. But this is happening all over the city, all over the country. And to the other talking point that's a dead-end talking point is that this is a result of austerity. Okay, this that's a cul-de-sac, in my view. That's a political dead-end because it's not about austerity. There's nothing austere about the budgets that they've spent on some of these buildings to basically give them a facelift to improve property values in the Kensington-Chelsea area and also as a nice little contract for whoever lucky enough to get the job of putting flammable material on the outside of a skyscraper. There's nothing austere about that. It's just total corruption. In fact, it's the opposite of austerity. It's just rampant opportunism and capitalism on that level.
Absolutely. Well, let's look at Sajid Javid because he's the community secretary. He has announced that the Grenfell Tower police-led investigation is underway, but it will be some time before it's fully understood how the fire started or why it took hold in the way it did. Now, we were told yesterday that there had been some arrests made already with a utility organization. I've had it confirmed from them, or at least they have categorically denied that any arrests have been made. So perhaps there's quite a lot of speculative information floating around at the moment. Sajid Javid said that in the meantime, there's some significant anxiety amongst residents about whether their own blocks are safe. While the exact reasons for the speed of the spread of the fire are yet to be determined, we have concluded that there are additional tests that can be undertaken with regard to the cladding and so on. He said, we have asked local authorities and all providers of social housing to identify whether any buildings in their area contain cladding made of aluminium composite material by the end of today. That was yesterday that he put this out. He said they're putting into place a rigorous government-funded testing process for any aluminium composite material cladding identified. I think David Scott pointed out last week that the testing processes which already have taken place, Brian, were woefully inadequate. What is it? He doesn't say anything here that would suggest to me that he's going to demonstrate better testing techniques. He said that it's clear that a considerable amount of work has already been undertaken. Councils are working closely with fire and rescue services to ensure the appropriate safety and response measures are in place and talking to their tenants to hear their concerns. And he says any landlord who's concerned can contact the department for advice. Well, there you go. That's pretty inadequate. Sorry, Patrick, that's a pretty inadequate response there.
But very typical because, of course, they've now, the government's now got the job to make it look as though they're going to take action. But just like child abuse, you can't take sufficient action to really get to the root of the problem, because that would start to reveal the inadequacies and the failures and the criminality within the government. Because the BBC, to be fair to the BBC, BBC quite rightly pointing a finger and saying four ministers, and this is across all three parties, four ministers informed of these fire risks and they did nothing. So the first people in my book to be brought forward would be the MPs themselves. I think we're going to watch a massive cover up, which will be on a par with the child abuse inquiry.
Well, let's talk about that in a second. Theresa May then says that she chaired the third meeting of the Grenfell Tower Recovery Task Force yesterday in the afternoon. And she apparently received updates on support for those affected, including on housing, access to payments from the discretionary fund, healthcare, and coordination on the ground. And she said, and the reports, the press release says that while it is clear that some progress is being made, the Prime Minister will continue to receive daily updates to ensure that steps taken are being carried forward at sufficient scale and speed that help getting the people getting help to people who need it. There doesn't seem to be too much action from her point of view. She's receiving updates on how things are going on the ground, but she doesn't seem to be taking a terribly proactive approach. But somewhere where she did take an absolutely proactive approach was on the issue of an inquest and not an inquiry. Now, the issue of an inquest or an inquiry is dependent on the definition of each. And as we pointed out a couple of days ago, an inquest can apportion blame. But, of course, she immediately jumped in with this judge-led public inquiry. Let's consider the differences. An inquest, as you know very well, Brian, with personal experience of this, an inquest is an independent investigation carried out by a coroner. Of course, there's the option for a jury. An incident of this scale, you would say that a jury would be appointed. And so there's some level of independence there, and the jury gets to hear the evidence and make a decision. In a public inquiry, although it can apportion blame and an inquest cannot apportion blame, the terms of reference of a public inquiry are set by the government. And of course, they're set in such a way that inquiries take a very long time. And of course, they're judge-led, and there's no opportunity for a jury to be appointed in a public inquiry. As we pointed out a few days ago, Theresa May doesn't have much of a track record when it comes to public inquiries. Depending on your point of view, of course, if what you're looking for is a cover-up, then she's got a spectacular track record. No, although public inquiries can apportion blame, no such blame has really been apportioned. So certainly no prosecutions in any of the public inquiries that have been held while she's been Home Secretary and while she's been Prime Minister.
Well, the common line is that, we recognise that the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea made some mistakes. They could have done things better. We've looked at our procedures. We've now updated our procedures. That's all been put in place. We're sure this will never happen again. Let's all move on. That's where the government is heading. That's where they'd like to go.
Well, what I'd like to see at this point is mass demands from around the country for a jury-led inquiry. And I'll just make the point, of course, that although it hasn't been used from the First World War, we should remember that there is the option still within British law for a grand jury. And that, I think, would probably be the best of the three options if the lawyers and the people involved in this would be could be encouraged to demand such an event. But let's move on to this. This is from the World Economic Forum. It's written by four alumni from a US university. Cities, not nation states, will determine our future survival, and here's why. And what they say is nation states are looking increasingly outdated and even dangerous. Some of them are outright belligerent and threatening catastrophic war, while some nation states are exhibiting neo-imperial tendencies. Most are waning in power and influence. The 369-year experiment in nation-building is coming unstuck, with most nation-states failing to deal with major global challenges of our era, including climate change, forced migration, terrorism, pandemics, and more. And so it goes on. And, of course, what they don't recognise is that it is the city, it is governance at the city level, at the local authority level and at the city level, which is causing events such as Grenfell Towers. So any demand or any claim that city states are going to determine our future survival, Patrick, this is nuts.
I'm not sure which university they're from.
Carnegie Mellon, I think. Is that?
Okay, in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
Okay, it's Carnegie Mellon University. So this is basically what millions of dollars in grant money allocated is used to churn up this sort of genius scenario. So look, if you look back at the history before, so what are they advocating for? A return to a coalition of city-states or to kingdoms, monarchies, or the nonstop warfare or the Peloponnesian city-states, or Sparta versus Troy or Persia. What are they advocating for here? They're saying the nation-state has failed, but they're not saying exactly what's going to replace it. And if this city-state parliament of mayors, which they're advocating for, is actually going to be better than the previous model. But you're correct in identifying that the huge source of corruption is at the local level.
That's absolutely right. And Brian, this is we have to keep in mind that it is the city infrastructure, the local infrastructure, the common purpose infrastructure, which has caused this event to happen.
Absolutely true, Mike, because the moment we have seen this New Deal for Communities plan come in, what it has done is given local authorities more and more power and the ability to simply dismiss any concerns from local people. And once they got the common purpose agenda in as well, we saw people in local authorities assume this all-powerful future leader status, where the arrogance was simply unbelievable.
So how do you, if you're looking into the future, how do you see cities run by this type of ideology?
Well, some people have said it's Blade Runner type city. We are going to see cities with draconian power. If you dare to criticise the local authority running that city, if you criticise the mayor and his private army of officials, you are going to be harassed, threatened, bullied, or possibly picked up on psychiatric charges, if you like. So this is very serious stuff. And if people think the infrastructure isn't in place to do these sorts of things, it absolutely is. Well, let's come back onto a very basic question. How many people have died in this fire? Now, 79 at the moment still appears to be the latest total. There's some references to this may increase, but the key factor is that local people are saying this cannot be true because hundreds of people were in the building. And if you do the basic statistics, as we did on UK column yesterday, then we are looking for somewhere between 300 and 500 people. Yesterday, I was able to have an audio interview with a lady, lives in the local area, watched the tower block burn. The next day, she was talking to local people and she was saying that the reports were that this building was stuffed full of people. There were people there not on the official register because probably they were illegal immigrants in the first place. There were many Muslims. And there were certainly many Muslims in that building after midnight because the fasting had stopped. And that was the time when those Muslim families would have been coming together to eat. And so we at the moment are being told a complete pack of lies. I tweeted out the question, Grenfell Tower, the key question, how many people were in the building at the time of the fire? And why do the authorities and media not ask? So this is the elephant in the room. I believe that this is part of trying already to manage the scale of this disaster.
The narrative being managed perhaps by some of the contractors. So this was the contractor that put the cladding on the wall of the tower. This was the page last week. This is the page today. And so already we're starting to see. And one of the questions that I'm asking, because Sajid Javid is saying, oh, the police inquiry has begun. The police inquiry should have begun on the day of the disaster. And the first thing that they should have done was to seize the email servers of everybody concerned.
Royal Borough Council, of Kensington and Chelsea, absolutely.
And the TMO and the contractors, every single contractor that was involved in this. Because I guarantee that a week has gone past almost, and I guarantee that a lot of cleanup has been done already on those emails.
Yeah. Well, let's come.
Sorry, Patrick. Yeah.
Let's interject on this issue of how many survivors there are. And also, this is absolutely connected to a public inquiry, because it's going to be very difficult. And we discussed this on Sunday on the radio show. But this is going to be very difficult when you have people rehoused. And we already know that people have been moved already outside of the borough of Kensington-Chelsea, despite any sort of promises that were made to keep people in the borough. So it's going to be difficult to, who do we speak to? Who do you speak to? Who's in charge of identifying? They can't even name who the survivors are now, and they can't even give an accurate death toll now. It's been a week almost. So, you know, my question is, have we lost information here, or is this purposely being diffused? It's going to be difficult. And plus, from the residents that we've spoken to, it seems that the council and the TMO are running a regime where people are under a regime of fear and intimidation. And so this is going to keep people from wanting to come forward for various reasons. They might lose their benefits. They might lose their council flat, for instance, or they might lose their place in the borough, for instance, the place they love, the place where their family and their friends are. These are very real fears that are probably going through people's heads right now. And also, I'm going to add that the government's offer of aid to the survivors, exactly how many survivors are going to get the £5,000 in their account and the £5,000 in cash, which they can pick up from the post office? Do we know exactly how many of these survivors there are? Shouldn't these figures be available so if the government's budgeting for it, isn't that based on some sort of verifiable number? And so is the state not capable of calculating how many have died, how many have survived? Forget about identifying them individually. They don't do that on plane crashes. When there's a plane crash, they look at how many people were inside the plane, roughly, give or take one or two. They come up and they announce the number, and then they go in through the process of identification. So why is that not being done here in this scenario? And that is absolutely tied to this the financial relief packages and also the potential inquiry. And I might say also that to offer somebody £5,500 after what has just gone on there, they'll be able to buy a new television set and a bed and maybe, you know, pay their council tax for the next 12 months. It's a joke.
Right. Well, just to put a figure on that, Theresa May announced this morning that £200,000 of that £5 million grant has been distributed so far. So assuming that they're operating anyway swiftly, you can calculate how many households have received their £5,500 to date. And it doesn't seem very many to me, Patrick.
OK.
All right. I'll just add, because we've got a couple of people asking some questions, I'll just say that tomorrow we will have part of that audio interview with the local person talking about comments from local people about how many people were in the block of flats. And what they are saying is not that this building was half empty, the exact opposite. They're saying this building was full of people, and many of the flats were crammed full of people. Because there were people there who probably weren't on the official books in UK. But we will have part of that audio report for you to listen to tomorrow. And it's pretty harrowing. And let's just come on to some basics. We've already mentioned that, of course, there was an application made for demolition regarding Grenfell Tower. Now, we don't know whether this was partial demolition of part of the structure or it was full demolition. But interestingly enough, we're going back to May 2014, just at the time all those fire concerns were coming up. Very interesting. And if you go and press the button to have a look at a bit more information on Kensington and Chelsea Borough Council page, you find that it's Royden Maintenance Limited is the agent there for the works, nature of works, description of works, demolition, Royden Maintenance. And thank you. I picked this up from this particular video, Grenfell Towers RBK demolition application. You might like to go and look at the video clip. I went to the source, and what the video author said is correct. So here it is on screen. And if we have a look at the Royden page, there's a big apology. And we've got Robert Bonds, the CEO of Royden Group, saying that he's personally shocked and devastated by what has happened. So at least there's an acknowledgement of the disaster on the page. But very interesting that an application for demolition should have been made, and then we have a serious fire. Well, back to the BBC. So this was the headline again, that the All Parliamentary Fire and Safety and Rescue Group warned the government it could not afford to wait for another tragedy like the Lakenel fire in London. And this is the meat of it. It says, so basically, it said, as a consequence, the group wishes to point out to you that should a major fire tragedy with loss of life occur between now and 2007, for example, in a residential care facility or a purpose-built block of flats, where the matters which had been raised here were found to be contributory to the outcome, then the group will be bound to bring this to others' attention. So there's the parliamentary group itself warning a warning. Now, the warnings went to four ministers, but the man I picked up on here, one went to the then Communities and Local Government Secretary, Eric Pickles, who received a letter about fire regulations from the parlementary group in February 2014. And of course, he did nothing. But let us remember that Eric Pickles was interested in something completely different. He said that he was going to shake up the balance of power in this country. He said he was going to change the nature of the constitution. He said, be in no doubt about our commitment to localism. I know I look like an unlikely revolutionary, but the revolution starts here. So Eric Pickles wasn't interested in fire safety because he was too busy fomenting revolution in the local communities. And I just want to stress this again. These people have been telling us how dangerous they are and what their true agenda is. This man, not interested in the lives of people in local communities, he was too busy fomenting revolution, his words. And of course, we have these two gentlemen. Nicholas Bowles MP said that the Tories were going to unleash chaotic effects. And in their vocabulary, chaos was a good thing. That's a pretty remarkable statement for the government. And Danny Kruger here, the Conservatives plan to introduce a period of creative destruction in the public services. So how does chaos and creative destruction save lives from fire? Well, of course, it doesn't. And these two men, who were both censured for what they said, unwittingly warned us that the political agenda in the UK was to foment chaos and destruction. And of course, when you achieve that state, people are going to die. Mm. They're going to die in fires, Mike, or the NHS, or violence, or something else. So, Patrick, for me, it is so clear that we've got a government that is interested in its own political agenda, transforming the country into something they want, not what we want. And they're prepared to put lives at risk in the process.
Yeah, this is you can blame the dysfunctionality of local government, of councils, of city and national governments. You can blame it on the fact that there's absolute chaos within the ranks of just about every institution in the country, from the NHS to the police to various sectors of government, and the local councils are rife with this unholy alliance between property developers and members of the council, and they're doing this completely over the heads and behind the backs of longtime residents. And it seems to me like a lot of money is being made by this relationship between the councils, wealthy landlords renting out their properties at well above market rates to the councils to provide what they call short-term or emergency housing, which turns out to be long-term housing. And they have been lining their pockets really for the last two decades gradually with this policy. And so no wonder that all of these, I don't want to bring in other issues, but they're like immigration, for instance, but you can see that there's definitely a commercial interest with some of these hot political issues where the beneficiaries are almost certainly making a lot of money by basically trying to game the system. And that's what I've seen happening here, especially in this borough. And the TMO is also an integral part of that.
Right. So, Patrick, you're describing these agendas running behind closed doors. What have these people been up to? Well, the Eric Pickles, who is fomenting revolution, is also part of the Conservative team that say that they are there changing our behaviour via their behavioural insights team. This is now mixed in with corporate interests. So these very dangerous politicians boasting that they can change our behaviour and views and values by applied psychology. We've got change agents like this man working in local government, Dominic Campbell. We put up a bit of video showing this man speaking on the stage about disruption and disruption and disruption and boasting that we needed to disrupt more of the civil service to get the change agenda the government wanted. Very dangerous man. We've got common purpose let loose inside the NHS and people inside the NHS saying we need a million change agents to make the NHS proper for the future. Well, in fact, what's happening is more deaths. And I'll just end by coming back to the BBC because the BBC here, Radio 4, in its news, also commenting on the tower block fire, and they wheeled out this man, Clive Coleman. And if you listen to what he says as legal affairs correspondent, he's gradually he's manipulating, I think, the audience very cleverly. That should be organisations. He's saying that basically it's all too difficult. You can't really prosecute anybody because it's so difficult. He explains the offence of corporate manslaughter, but that's very difficult. These big organisations have got lots of layers of policy and people. They've got training on safety, so it's very hard to get at the top people. On he goes. More likely that prosecutions will be under health and safety laws. Although these laws can provide fines and imprisonment, the public's not impressed when they hear health and safety. I think what he's up to is this is starting to manage public expectations. And of course, he doesn't mention the people with the overall responsibility for this fire, which is the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea and the Tenants Management Organisation.
Well, the locals have put out a public, an open letter. This is not quite a finished draft, but they've asked it to be distributed anyway. It says it's a list of demands from residents, and the demands are these. All Grenfell residents should be given immediate housing, which cannot be taken away from them within the borough of Kensington. That senior TMO officials must face an independent inquiry. That all tower blocks are re-evaluated for safety risks, that regeneration plans must stop until their purpose is re-evaluated and re-evaluated in public, and finally that survivors must be told the true casualty rates and that families of survivors should be allowed into the country at least temporarily, as this is the minimum emotional support that survivors require. And I think those four requirements are absolutely appropriate.
Essential. And interesting, again, the common sense, Mike, has come from people on the ground in that area. These are not the demands of the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea. It's taken local people to come out with common sense demands as to what should happen next.
Yes. Well, of course, one of the, as we mentioned yesterday, the news agenda is wanting to move on, Patrick, and put this behind it. I don't think we're going to allow that to happen. But anyway, one of the news stories which was part of that drive was the Finsbury Park so-called terrorist incident. You've got a headline on 21st Century Wire here saying Finsbury Park cover-up. Why are you calling it a cover-up?
Well, the thing that was extraordinary about this Finsbury Park story, which just appeared yesterday in the news cycle, was what a non-event it was. And I don't mean to belittle anybody's injuries or anything that might have happened in this incident, but they immediately called it. Theresa May went on national television, gave her statement, I believe it was from Downing Street at about 12:30 yesterday afternoon, and boasted how the police responded in 1 minute, and it was declared a terrorist attack in 8 minutes. Now, can you please tell me how it's possible, without doing an investigation, to label something a terrorist event within 8 minutes? And so that's the beginning of the story. So what exactly happened here? We're told that a man from Cardiff, a 47-year-old man, Mr. Drove his white rented van into a group of men, Muslim men, who are coming out of the Muslim Friends Center in Finsbury Park, just near the Finsbury Park Mosque, at around midnight, and then basically, supposedly, allegedly plowed through them. And so what exactly did happen here? Was this a terrorist attack, or was this something else? Because the statement that we read, which was released to the media, I believe by the police, indicated when the story blew, it said that one person died in a terrorist attack, 10 injured. Now, I read back on the reports that were released after the media storm calmed down, and it said that there was an elderly gentleman who had collapsed from unrelated circumstances and who was in the path of the road being helped by many others when this took place. So this could have been a bad driver or someone who hit. Maybe he was a racist or anti-Muslim, Islamophobic gentleman in the car, and that could be, yeah? But was it a premeditated terrorist attack? That's not clear, because clearly the elderly gentleman in question did not sustain his injuries because of the van. That's actually a big part of this story, which was completely glossed over by the media. Add to this, three separate eyewitnesses that we have on camera, we have the videos up at 21st Century Wire, are saying that there's a fourth witness too, but that's been erased from the web, but saying that there were three men in the van, and one came out to fight the crowd, was then subdued, two did a runner. So there are three men in the van. So where did this talking point come from? Should this be pursued and investigated further? If there are two fugitives of a terrorist event on the loose or at large currently, that's kind of a big story. So, you know, this was set on camera on three different networks, by the way, three different people. So it wasn't an isolated comment. So I think there's definitely worth looking into. But we were just highlighting that fact because this was not debated or discussed in the media at all. But this was a very convenient way to bury the Grenfell Tower tragedy with what it looked to be like. I'm not sure this was a terrorist event. And I don't mean to belittle anybody who's been involved or minimize any of their injuries or anything like that. But let's look at this for what it is before we jump to the conclusion and make it into a national terrorism media story. So that's my question.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Look, Pat, we've only got 7 minutes left. So let's move to the Middle East here quickly. This is the Serious Fraud Office, who has charged Barclays Bank in the UK and four of its recent executives with fraud over money that was raised, billions of pounds, to bail them out during the financial crash in 2008. So they've leveled charges against Barclays and against John Varley, their former chief executive, and three of his colleagues, Roger Jenkins, Thomas Collaris, and Richard Both. And this is to do with £11.8 billion of emergency fundraising, which they got a large proportion of that from Qatar, private interests in Qatar. What's interesting to me here, Patrick, is the timing of this, because, of course, well, Theresa May was speaking to the Emir of Kuwait last night, saying that she welcomed the leading role that Kuwait is playing in mediating between Gulf states to find a solution to the ongoing isolation of Qatar in the region. And it seems to me that there's a bit of duplicity going on here, because Theresa May saying that she welcomes the role Kuwait is playing to deal with the find a solution to the ongoing isolation of Qatar, while at the same time deploying the Serious Fraud Office to hit Barclays at this moment in time when Qatar is implicated in this alleged fraud.
Sure. Quite simple. This is just a simple analysis here, is that they're sending a message out to all financial institutions. This is what it appears to me, to do not do business with Qatar. Qatar in the process of isolating this country. And this is not particularly for anything that they've done. that other UK and US allies do on a regular basis, and the US and the UK do themselves, which is arm and support terrorism in the Middle East. Qatar has been doing that, yes, but so has Saudi Arabia, so has the United States, and so is the UK and France and many others. That's not it. But what they're doing is isolating Qatar, putting them in a sort of pen with Iran right now. Possibly Turkey is also might be included in that pen. And they're trying to draw sort of geopolitical fault lines in the Middle East to further isolate Iran, is the big target in this exercise. So right now they're trying to cut off financial ties and discourage people from doing business with that particular Gulf state.
Okay, now yesterday we mentioned that the United States had shot down a Syrian army jet. This is Sputnik here reporting that the Kremlin is seriously concerned over the U.S. coalition's actions in Syria. The Kremlin spokesperson said that the situation linked to the coalition's actions is seriously concerning. That was followed up with claims by the United States, an acknowledgement that they'd done it, but claims that they had a right to self-defense. As Newsweek here is saying, the war of words over Syria. But this risks becoming something significantly more than a war of words. Apparently Australia recognises that this risks becoming significantly more than a war of words because they have grounded their aircraft and will not take part in further air activities with the United States because of what they see as Russia-US tensions over the downed Damascus jet. That's reported by RT. And RT saying that the Russian military have basically closed the air corridors and are now refusing access for U.S. Coalition aircraft over that airspace. As far as the U.S. coalition is concerned, that's now a no-fly zone, and Russia making it absolutely clear that they will take action against anybody that moves into that area. So this is becoming a very hot situation, Patrick. And as you say on 21st Century Wire, though, you're bringing in the Iranian aspect of this. So just briefly, give us your thoughts on it.
Yeah, sure. The Russia basically declaring an end to deconfliction cooperation with the United States. In other words, Syria and the U.S. have tolerated the United States' presence in Syria, supposedly in the fight against ISIS, because everybody knows, we all know that if one U.S. jet goes down or one U.S. serviceman happens to die as a result of a Syrian army or a Russian military asset, then that's going to create a sort of a wider war. The U.S. media machine will then kick into gear. They will begin consensus building and then amassing a military operation to reflect something like Iraq in 2003. Okay, the U.S. is just looking for an excuse. The neoconservatives are looking for that excuse. So is Israel. So is Saudi Arabia probably as well. So you can see how the forces are being aligned right now. So that's a very dangerous development. The U.S. is poking and prodding Syrian and Russian defenses, looking for a reaction, testing their patience. But then what's happened is there was a twin suicide bomb attack by ISIS in Tehran 2 weeks ago in Iran. Okay, that's a major event. ISIS took credit for it. Was it ISIS? We're not sure. The details are in this article and the debate is open there. But Iran seems to have called the West bluff, co-opted its anti-ISIS narrative. And this is Iran, who the United States and Saudi Arabia maintain is the number one state sponsor of terror on the planet. Okay, so now we have ISIS attacking Iran, Iran hitting back with a missile launch they haven't done in 30 years, fired a missile outside of their own borders. Okay, so this is a significant event. They fired over Iraqi airspace into Syria, hitting ISIS targets near Deir ez-Zor. Okay, so in retaliation for this twin terrorist attack. So that this is a game changer in the sense that it's going to further complicate and also increase possibly the tensions. It may force the hand of the U.S. to continue going down the dead end that it's pursuing right now. And that's very worrying. Okay, so tensions are increased. What my worry is that regardless of the strategic upper hand that one country might feel that it has by acting and calling bluffs, that might be true. But if an all-out war breaks out, it's not going to matter at the end of the day. They'll just turn that part of Syria into an ash heap and maybe every other major city in the area. So it's a huge risk, and not just on the part of Iran, but on the part of the U.S., who I think is provoking the aggression and the tension in the region right now, is the United States and its allies, including the U.K., including France, everyone else who has troops inside of Syria against international law. They are provoking a wider war. And that's what we're looking at right now.
Right. And in just two words, do you think, because I'm interested in the position of Trump here, is he approving these actions? Or is this the case that because I remember him saying at the very beginning that he was going to give his people the authority that they needed to act. So is this a local decision that's being made on the ground on the borders of Syria? Or is this getting approval from the White House for every one of these incidents?
I don't think so. I don't think Trump is in control at all. He signaled very early on, even late in his campaign, that he will defer to what he calls the generals. And so his envoy is General James Mattis, defense secretary. That's his liaison to the Pentagon, basically. And I can tell you the Pentagon is 100% in control, and they go to Donald Trump to rubber stamp decisions. But so these decisions are probably being taken completely independently of the executive of the United States. I think Donald Trump is, although he puts on a strong show, in real terms, he might be one of the weakest presidents in U.S. history, because he did the thing that you should never do as a leader. He signaled early, even before he was sworn into office, that he trusts the military and the generals to make all his decisions for him. Okay. Now, whether you take that counsel or not, that's up to you as a leader, but you never go to the people and say that you will not, the buck does not stop with you. That's a huge mistake that Donald Trump made. And I think that's because generally he's in over his head, basically. He's not a swamp dweller. He's not equipped to survive in the swamp. And he made a huge, huge mistake early on in his presidency by giving so much power to the Pentagon, who are really a bunch of agents of a giant military industrial complex that just sees long-term war and intensity conflicts as the way forward in order to manage a military economy.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
All right, Patrick, thank you very much for that. We just end on this one slide. Of course, if we look at Westminster, the problem is cross-party, the Lib Lab con. All three of the major parties lie about Syria. They lie about the NHS. They lie about fire safety. We feel they're not fit for purpose and they need to be replaced. And of course, the political parties themselves, the evidence that they're totally corrupt is overwhelming. They need to be outlawed. So we're coming on to constitutional issues as to how we deal with these terrible events taking place, not only in UK, but worldwide. As always, violence is not the answer. And we're watching with interest people such as Corbyn's team calling for very large marches on the streets. Well, do these achieve anything? If there's violence involved, it achieves nothing. We need a great many good people to be standing up and challenging the individual members of Parliament. They are the people responsible. They should be held to account as individuals. Mm. That's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow at 1 o'clock. And of course, we will have that audio interview with regard to Grenfell Tower block fire. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.